If you thought the BBC or CNN are the most watched TV stations in the world, well, think again. CCTV, China Central Television, beats them both with 1.2 billion global viewers. In her new book, 2 Billion Eyes, The Story of China Central Television, Ying Zhu, professor and chair of the Department of Media Culture at City University of New York, offers the inside story of China's influential state-owned television network through interviews with senior executives, anchors, and experts. It's published by the New Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Ying Zhu to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
Why do you say CCTV is a microcosm of Chinese-style state capitalism?
Well, first of all, CCTV, the China Central Television, is the only national TV network in China, and it's a state-owned and controlled commercial broadcaster that is financially self-reliant and operationally autonomous, but politically dependent. And so, and it is a public TV yet for profit, and operates according to the market principles, or a commercial broadcaster beholden to the party state in the name of public.
So this is very confusing. On the one hand, it's expected to pay its own way, or does it still get some money from the state?
It's basically operating on the market principle now. The state subsidy has dwindled to, almost to nothing.
So, but that's despite the fact that the state still maintains a lot of control.
Right. The state owns the broadcaster, and state controls the broadcaster, but it, has left it to fend for itself on the market force.
Now, when did this start happening? There was obviously state television before this arrangement.
CCTV was funded in 1978, basically took off Beijing Television, which was funded in 1958. And the year after it, Beijing TV was changed to CCTV, the name of CCTV, and it started to introduce a certain market mechanism, which follows the general trend of marketization in China.
So this is during Deng Xiaoping's period.
That's right. The immediately after, incidentally, 1978, when CCTV was founded, was the year China officially launched its economic reform policy.
Does CCTV have any competition in China?
Yes. Variety of local competitions, local challenges. My book featured two in particular. One, Hunan Satellite TV, which has over the years aggressively courted CCTV's youth audiences. And then there's the Phoenix Television, which is based in Hong Kong, that has aggressively courted high end of CCTV's audiences.
Are they privately run?
None.
So they have similar arrangements to CCTV?
Well, CCTV is the only national television and network.
And we should point out there are a lot of channels.
24 channels, inclusive of these foreign language services. The most recent one actually being the one just opened up earlier this year, CCTV America, broadcasting in English. Hunan Television is one of the chief local challengers, which aggressively produce youth-oriented entertainment program. And the other, I should qualify what I said earlier, because the other major challenge of CCTV is Phoenix. Phoenix actually is a joint venture between a Chinese businessman and the former subsidiary of one of Rupert Murdoch's television company.
Well, since Phoenix TV is headquartered in Hong Kong, does it enjoy more press freedom?
Oh, absolutely. It does. And Phoenix does not have... Phoenix gained its... one of the channels at Phoenix gained its landing right in China a few years back. Phoenix's presence in China is very much restricted to the big major cosmopolitan area, and also the five-star hotels.
What was CCTV like before Yang Weiguang became its president in 1991?
CCTV started to undergo structure change, aggressively move towards expansion marketization under Yang Weiguang's reign. And before Yang Weiguang, CCTV's subsidy decreased, state subsidy decreased throughout the 1980s. And when Yang Weiguang took over, he really aggressively pushed for marketization.
And by doing that, perhaps gave the CCTV a little more freedom, because he did nudge it into more quality news reporting.
Yes, he in fact, throughout the 1990s, there was a new generation of CCTV journalists who were very excited about particularly three investigative programs that took off under Yang Weiguang's reign. One is called Oriental Horizon, launched in 1993. And the second one is called Focus, launched in the year after. And then 2 years later, in 1996, there was a third investigative program that's emulated after 60 Minutes, U.S. program 60 Minutes. The three investigative programs aggressively reported stories about corruption, about power abuse, and so on.
But I would assume, based on everything that I've read, when there's a story about corruption, it's because the government wants that story about corruption to be aired. How involved does the government get in news reporting and in these kinds of investigative reports?
Make no mistake, censorship is still kind of a top-down operation in Chinese media in general, and CCTV also in particular. But over the years, though, the control has gradually downshifted from top down strict censorship to a mixture of government censorship and self-censorship. And so I guess, at this point, it's very much a negotiation. Yes, the state allows a certain leeway for the journalists to tackle some of the sensitive issues. But when it comes down to a real sensitive issues, such as, the CCTV will never report the article about the Chinese premier Wen Jiabao that's published in the New York Times. And for other issues, other problems in terms of demonstration and power abuse and so on and so forth, CCTV does have some leeway in negotiating and, make their own producing their stories.
Wasn't Focus restricted to two critical reports a week at most?
Yes, there was a policy, especially for Focus. Focus was very, very popular when it was launched in the mid-1990s, right?
Because people felt it was kind of opening up.
Absolutely. There was a genuine, euphoria among the CCTV practitioners. People were very happy. And in fact, the show was so popular that, a lot of story it did, it does the next day, it becomes a water cooler topic, among the public. But when it aggressively does more, touches more sensitive issues, it touches the law nerve among particularly the Chinese plutocrats. So the establishment, stepped in and saying you have to scale back. So it stipulated, wait a minute, you can only do two stories a week. And you have to also consider the timing and the selection of the topic, also about your angle of your criticism.
Did any of the CCTV channels cover the Bo Xilai scandal?
Not that I'm aware of.
So would that be because the government would say, don't do that? Or is it because of what you suggested earlier, there's also a lot of self-censorship? We know just what lines we can't cross.
That's right. It's a mixture of both. It's a mixture of both. At the end of the day, it is really a bread butter issue for a lot of practitioners, and their jobs are on the line. Over the years, the Chinese stay, the political wing shifts ever so frequently, and it's very difficult for journalists to kind of parse out and what is permissible. And so they really, this kind of on-the-job training has produced a generation of media practitioners who, automatically intuiting what's permissible, what should be put on the table. So in a case of Bo Xilai, of course, nobody dared to touch the topic.
My guest is Ying Zhu, who's written a book called 2 Billion Eyes, The Story of China Central Television. It is published by The New Press. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some years ago, I spoke to a Romanian writer, Norman Manya, about what happened when Ceausescu lifted all of the censorship rules. He said things were much more dangerous then. They preferred the rules because then you knew what you couldn't say and what wouldn't get you in trouble. But when there were no rules, sometimes you could say something very daring and it would be okay. But then sometimes you'd say something and you'd find yourself in jail.
Precisely.
And I'm sure that that's what's happening with the journalists here. Do some of them wind up in serious trouble?
Yes. And again, this is a fine line. You know, people struggle every day.
When Yang stepped down in 1999, was it because there were some tensions with the government?
Not really, though. When Yang stepped down, he really has reached retirement age. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to just sort of take off and go back to do his own, he actually has his own media company. And then what happens is the next president came on board, and he really very much aggressively pushed for commercialization and really blurred the line between a commercial broadcaster and public broadcaster.
Now, would these people have come out of broadcasting, or would they have come out of business, or would they have come out of government?
Yang Weiguang, you know, my book featured a succession of CCTV leaders. The first one is Yang Weiguang. Yang Weiguang came from radio. He's the radio man, and that's what he loved to do.
So there's still hope for me.
That's right. I was told radio is more fun than TV. So he was a radio man, and the irony is he was called in to really try to build up a television. And back then, radio is starting to feel the threat from a television. So he was called in to compete with his own beloved medium.
Well, radio was everywhere, and TV is something that you need electrification and all sorts of other things to be able to watch. But as China became more industrialized and became more electrified, TV would become a more popular medium. And commercialization was seen as the way encouraged by the state because it would have been so expensive to do this all by itself?
To a certain extent, yes. And also this is really follows the general trend of marketization in China as well. And I guess this gets back to the point about the China model in a way you asked at the beginning, to what extent CCTV is a microcosm of Chinese state capitalism.
Well, when Yang was replaced by Hua Yong, right?
Yeah.
Who you say reformed the network by building specialty channels, individualized columns, and quality high-end programs. But then there was the show River Elegy, a 1988 documentary that was thought by the state to have instigated the student movement in 1989 in Tiananmen Square. Did people pay a price for that?
Well, the producers, the production team certainly had paid price for that, and the director, very young at the time, fresh out of college, graduate school, and Xia Jun, whom I interviewed, had extensive discussion and conversation in the book, and he, you know, was forced out of CCTV and was, imposed the self-exile and walked around countryside for 5 years.
Walked around the countryside.
I suppose literally walked around.
While he was re-educated.
Right, and he was making documentaries, actually, which was never aired, the documentaries he made during the time of exile. Yeah.
Did CCTV report on the Tiananmen Square uprising?
It did for a very short period of time when the top level the party standing committee and Politburo members were in disagreement about how to handle the student movement. That actually provided an opportunity for CCTV to exercise, act on the professional instinct. And then they did report it, and the student movement, up until when the state really come in and say, let's stop.
Now, when the state says stop, do they report it then from the state's point of view?
Oh, absolutely.
It can't be ignored. It just winds up taking on a whole different tone.
That's right. Much like an earthquake cannot be ignored, you have to report it.
Was that similar to what happened in 2008 with the Sichuan earthquake?
Yes, yes, that's very much the case. And obviously, but by then, things have changed, you know, drastically. The control has lessened to a great extent because the kind of draconian propaganda and effort has proved to be ineffective, right?
And also the internet has made all sorts of information available.
Right. Right, right. You want to say cannot possibly control the information flow in and out of the national border. And earthquake is not something that's, you know, small. It's not a mysterious an illness that you can cover up.
But wasn't that coverage something of a breakthrough? Other natural disasters had been kind of covered up or not dealt with in much detail. What happened here? How did CCTV manage to get around the censorship to cover the earthquake?
Well, the CCTV's coverage of the earthquake is certainly an instant milestone, make no mistake about this. A couple of things happened. One is, of course, the gradual loosening up. And the fact that internet opened up competition, CCTV had to compete with internet. And other non-government entities elsewhere. So they have to step in. And the other thing is, during the, you know, hours after the earthquake, the state was just so shocked and they failed to respond. So there was no directive from the regulators. So the professionals, CCTV was able to send their journalists to the disaster zone. And only hours later, when the regulators realized that, wait a minute, you know, I have to do something. And they issued a directive that basically says all the local broadcasters are barred from entering the disaster zone, which means that CCTV and also the other national broadcaster, not broadcaster, I'm sorry, newspaper agency, Xinhua News Agency, are the two only state-sanctioned broadcasters who are able to cover the story. And so CCTV basically monopolized the airwave at the time.
But with a government point of view, I mean, I'd imagine now this has become something of a non-story. That's the reason Ai Weiwei is under house arrest, because he wanted to continue talking about the scandals involved with all the buildings that that fell as a result of that earthquake.
Well, yeah, that's interesting because, again, make no mistake, censorship still is there. Even though CCTV allowed us a window of opportunity to exercise its professional instinct or responsibility to carry the story, CCTV did not really cover the school building collapse. Even though it mentions school building collapse, it did not really talk about this from the perspective of, you know, the anguish of the suffering, the government, the state abuse, power abuse, and corruption. It didn't. And again, CCTV was exercising this kind of censorship.
My guest is Ying Zhu, professor and chair of the Department of Media Culture at City University of New York, College of Staten Island. Her book is called 2 Billion Eyes, The Story of China Central Television. It is published by the New Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ying Zhu, whose book is 2 Billion Eyes, The Story of China Central Television. It's published by the New Press. People recognize that CCTV is really a mouthpiece of the government. So why does it have such a large global viewership?
Maybe we want to talk about domestic dominance first.
Okay.
Now, this has to do with, in fact, actually CCTV's structure. China has this kind of so-called four-tier television structure where TV stations are set up at national, provincial, county, and local levels. And both national and local regulators operate their own TV stations and service audiences within their own sort of administrative boundaries. And because of that, TV stations, broadcasting bureaus, and government at the same administrative level are closely linked in economic and political exchange. So, and it is in the best interest of CCTV's direct supervisor, which is the State Administration of Radio, Film, and TV, SAFT. It is in the best interest of SAFT to protect CCTV's market domestic market share. And of course, ideologically, it relies on CCTV to carry on its message. And economically, CCTV, since it's waned from state subsidy, it turned around and become very profitable. It remits a fraction of its profit to SOFT. So it is in the best SOFT's best interest to keep CCTV dominant, has majority of the market share in China.
But what about audiences? Do most people believe what they see on television?
I highly doubt. Well, depending on what you look at.
We're talking about a population that for years, many people ran around with a little red book and quoted Chairman Mao, even though some of those things in that little red book were kind of silly. I'm sure there are a fair number of true believers still, but there are many doubters. In fact, CCTV is made fun of on Chinese Facebook and Twitter. One joke I've heard from Renren, after last night's presidential election here, says, pattern of Chinese media. One, political leaders are busy. Two, Chinese people are happy. Three, America is bad.
That's right. And this is actually talking about the must carry news primetime, Chinese primetime news program that is produced from CCTV for CCTV One, but all the local televisions must carry this program, no matter whether you like it or not. And so, let's look at the CCTV audience. So CCTV, tends to attract middle-aged and older audiences, urbanites, and also, I have to say, the vast majority of rural audiences for lack of access to other alternative, information channels. And so they continue to rely on CCTV. And
did people just try to read between the lines?
Oh, people have been reading between the lines for the, past decades. Right, that's how things are and how things were, right?
What role has CCTV played in stirring up nationalistic feelings against Japan?
That's a complicated issue. I think it's more of the sort of interaction between the sort of genuine nationalistic sentiment among a certain segment of Chinese population, and CCTV come out to reinforce this kind of view. CCTV is not necessarily an instigator in some of these nationalistic outpourings.
So, but it still is one of the sources of information that get people upset. If people doubt what they're watching, or rather cynical, they still can be touched by certain stories?
They could. But when it comes to kind of a nationalistic, outpouring outburst or movements, actually internet carries more weight to a certain extent than television itself.
What can we learn from some of the other shows? There's a program called Rise of the Powerful Nations.
Yeah, that's a very interesting show. This show is actually often compared to Rivalry, which in 1989, when it came out, it was considered as the instigator of the student movement in 1988. Decades later, the CCTV Economics Channel actually produced this epic-scale documentary. Basically, it looked at and the formation and coming into power of the major nations, Western nations in the history. It is also part of the kind of a party effort to look to the West and learn lessons from the West.
But you say it's also an example of China's new style of propaganda.
Nation building. Right, propaganda, in a way, nation building. Right.
And they even issue books and DVDs based on the series?
Well, the series was because it was very popular.
So popular? Does it explain, is it partly because the Chinese still are confused about how they went from being the greatest nation on earth to a country that was so ravaged by the West?
Well, the documentary series was actually about Western nation building in the West. So it attempts to draw on the lesson about how West and how the major powers come into being and to really facilitate China's rise into the world. And it basically tries to educate domestic audiences about what we can do to continue to build China into the, global real empire of some sort.
China Central Television is no longer the state-funded network it used to be. It's become dynamic and commercial, operating on market principles while abiding to state censorship. It's the topic of Ying Zhu's new book called 2 Billion Eyes, the story of China's central television. There are, we mentioned there are other channels as well. This is kind of like watching cable television in a way, except that there are, 25, 30 channels? There's a finance and economics channel. Does that enjoy more journalistic freedom than some of the others?
Well, this is very interesting because I remembered there was an article actually talks about CCTV America, and one of the consultants for CCTV America, an American journalist, talked about, he said CCTV's, the business of CCTV is business.
Mm-hmm.
So, and yes, you're right, you know, economic news, business news is relatively a freer, you know, place and for people to do a more interesting sort of a daring program. There's a relatively loose control there.
As long as you don't talk about things like freedom of speech and things like that, you're okay. But business entrepreneurship is encouraged.
Yes. Yes, to a certain extent. But then that gets back to the China model. Because when we talk about China model, we really, you know, what's at the root of the China model? It really is the kind of a combination of a market economy and also authoritarian control. Right, where the state has monopoly over major economic resources, and state-owned the companies have huge influence over China's political and economic directions, and then the two, you know, the power and the money have converged in their need to maintain the status quo, and where reform and also entrepreneurship have been installed.
Does CCTV get involved in the social media?
Oh, CCTV has its own, you know, website. Yeah, it's very much involved. But how many people really are interested in getting information from CCTV online news? That's an entirely different issue.
Well, you did mention that CCTV now has a whole bunch of foreign language channels. In an interview with Barry Van Rijk of Danway.com, you said CCTV has global ambitions.
Oh, yes, international ambitions. And I'd like to mention a very interesting anecdote. And CCTV only in 1986, I believe. And Yang Weiguang, the then president, made a history by broadcasting as headline news on China's primetime television the explosion of the Challenger spacecraft. And because prior to that, you know, nobody dared to international news as the, you know, top billing news on national TV. So he made a history. So time, you know, decades passed, and, you know, now we're really talking about CCTV aggressively expanding into the international terrain. It has several foreign language services, Russian, Spanish language channels, Russian, Arabic channels, French.
Spanish and French.
That's right. And
now CCTV America.
That's right.
But CCTV America is actually based in the United States?
In Washington, D.C.
What's its main goal, do you think? Do you think it's aimed at non-Chinese or Chinese Americans?
Both non-Chinese. So people who are interested in China affairs. And I suspect a lot of the, you know, actually business people would be very interested in this channel. You know, CCTV established its first English channel in 2000, and in 2001, the state launched this kind of going out project. And this is why, and this is at, you know, the moment when CCTV started aggressively to expand to the market, to the foreign market. Going out project is to project China's voice overseas. Two things, two goals it attempts to observe. One is to project China's perspective on world affairs, China's perspective on a U.S. election, right, and China's perspective on the, you know, world economic crisis. And the other thing is really to try to change the narrative about China globally. You know, for the most part, the narrative about China is you know, negative. And the CCTV international services attempt to change that. The irony of that is, though, even though it attempts to change the narrative about China, but it was not allowed to touch a lot of sensitive stories about China. So CCTV America or other international language services, you know, is far from being the credible resources for people to, you know, seek information about China.
Well, a similar goal was in the creation of Voice of America, and there were criticisms about self-censorship there as well, not ever revealing anything embarrassing about the United States. But I'm really curious about how you got some of these people to talk to you, because you have a lot of interviews here where the people, and I mean, use their names. You don't just say a spokesman said or a notable TV host or an anchor told me. You actually give their names. Weren't they at all afraid about being so outspoken?
I think any time when you do this kind of interview, there's ethical issue involved, and I do have to touch and check off with them. Is that okay, and so on and so forth. And I do balance out the need to reveal the information and the need to withhold certain information. And I guess the question is how do I have access to these people? I don't suppose.
Did
I
you
should.
Have to get permission?
I did seek official permission, but as anything in China, it's very gray. There's never a real official permission or never a real official ban says no. But I certainly cannot reveal my deep throat here on radio. But on the other hand, I think ultimately my Chinese face helps. And that's what I was told during my interview with these famous personalities. When they turn down Western-faced journalists, they do feel the kind of connection with someone with wearing Chinese face.
Many of CCTV's American reporters and anchors are, in fact, Western journalists who used to work for ABC, CNN, Al Jazeera, English. Where can I find it? I mean, I have Time Warner Cable. Is it on one of the channels?
Yes,
there?
It is. Yes, it is. It's bundled together. Yeah.
But you don't know where it is on the
dial. I believe Warner Brothers.
Time Warner.
The Time Warners. Their cable has the CCTV's program.
And I want to thank you so much for being on our show, Ying Zhu. She is a professor and chair of the Department of Media Culture at City University of New York College of Staten Island. She is the author and editor of seven other books, including Art, Politics, and Commerce in Chinese Cinema. Now she has moved on to Chinese television with a book called 2 Billion Eyes, The Story of China's Central Television. It is published by the New Press, and it's been fascinating talking about the world's largest television network. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.